Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Black turtlenecks, blonde hair, the world in the palm of her hand.
You founded this company 12 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Tell them how old you were.
I was 19. Yeah.
Don't worry about the future. We're in good hands.
Not only was former President Bill Clinton charmed by Elizabeth Holmes, but by the time this Clinton Global Initiative conversation took place in 2015, Holmes was the youngest billionaire in the world, sharing the stage with the likes of humanity's other tech power brokers such as Jack Ma, China's Alibaba founder. And why? Well, Holmes seemed to be every bit the female Steve Jobs. She dropped out of Stanford, founded a company at the tender age of 19, a company that promised to revolutionize healthcare. Here's what Elizabeth Holmes said her company, Theranos, had done.
Created these little tiny tubes, which we call the nanotainers, which are designed to replace the big traditional tubes that come from your arm and instead allow for all the testing to be done from a tiny drop from a finger.
Not only would those nanotainers make blood draws virtually painless, Holmes' breathtaking promise was that since you could do an entire blood panel from a teeny tiny drop, Theranos would be able to predict future diseases.
We invested very heavily in software in the context of automating the traditional analytical process, and importantly, what's called the pre-analytical and post-analytical processes. So We work to design a process that is highly automated.
Well, that word scramble meant something to Silicon Valley investors. Henry Kissinger, Rupert Murdoch, Oracle founder Larry Ellison, the chain Walgreens flocked to her passion and the promise of profit.
The promise of Silicon Valley and these places in the world in which there's so much creativity is that we can demonstrate that there are models for doing well by doing good.
This is on point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and to this day, I find that heady dance between self-confidence and self-delusion that drives Silicon Valley's most audacious founders to be just astounding. I mean, if Larry Page and Sergey Brin can make $1 zillion with the outlandish promise to catalog every bit of human knowledge in the world, and they do it? Well, then why couldn't Elizabeth Holmes do the same thing by transforming healthcare as we know it? Except that she couldn't.
So a clinical laboratory is where you actively process patient samples.
Enter Erica Chung, the real heroine of this story. She and her family of six grew up in a one-room trailer. She went to Berkeley, got degrees in molecular and cellular biology and linguistics, too. And in 2014, Theranos hired Chung, which is why, pretty quickly, she found some problems when she entered the Theranos lab.
And so before I would run a patient sample, I would have a sample where I knew what the concentration was. And in this case, it was 0.2 for TPSA, which is an indicator of whether someone has prostate cancer or is at risk of prostate cancer or not. But when I run it in the Theranos device, it would come out 8.9. And then I'd run it again, and it'd come out 5.1. And I'd run it again, and it'd come out 0.5, which is technically in range. But what do you do in this scenario?
Well, if you're Erica Chung, you're very, very smart, and you respect the truth. And as she describes in this TED Talk, she started to see a pattern. Massaged data, falsified results to regulators.
What we had done is we had taken the sample and we had run it through an FDA-approved machine and we had run it through the Theranos device. And guess what happened? We got two very, very different results. So what do you think they did in this scenario? You would anticipate that you would tell the regulators, like, we have some discrepancies here with this new technology. But instead, Theranos had sent the results of the FDA-approved machine. So what is the signal to you?
It signals that Elizabeth Holmes, Theranos' founder, was lying. Chung eventually went to the Wall Street Journal, which went public with its reporting of fraud allegations in 2015. And you probably know the rest of the story by now, because last week, Elizabeth Holmes was found guilty in federal court of defrauding her investors. So what we've been wondering is, how does this happen? What is it about Silicon Valley and the billions of dollars sloshing around there that made this possible? Part hubris, part fake it till you make it, part hope seduced by hype and the dream of finding that next world-changing unicorn. I mean, is this simply the risk that investors take? And is it the cost of nurturing really big ideas? Or is there something deeper about how Silicon Valley works that's the problem? Well, joining us now is Dr. Bijan Salehizadeh, co-founder of Navimed Capital. He's been a healthcare venture capitalist and private equity investor for more than 20 years. Dr. Salehizadeh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Salehizadeh, you met Elizabeth Holmes in 2006. Can you tell us what your first impressions were of her?
Well, Meghna, it was a meeting like any other meeting we have in the venture capital or investment business. Hundreds of these meetings I take a year, where an entrepreneur comes in and tells me the story of the thing they're inventing or the company they've built. It takes about an hour or 90 minutes, and I ask questions. And this occurred back in 2006. Elizabeth Holmes sat across a small round conference table from me in my office then on Sand Hill Road in the heart of Silicon Valley. And it was like every other meeting. She presented what they wanted to do with blood testing on the device that they were building. And this was the very early part of Theranos. They were maybe 3 or 4 years old. This was before the magazine covers and before the TED Talks. And I asked the kinds of questions that, with my medical training and background, and even as a young venture capitalist at that point, just 3 years into my career, I knew to ask, which was a really simple question. How does the device work? Tell me a little bit more about the technology in the device. How will you do this at a level of detail? And what was unusual about that meeting, maybe the only unusual thing about that meeting, is that she didn't, couldn't, wouldn't answer that question. Very strange, because every other entrepreneur that sits in front of you to raise money from you, to get money that you are investing in companies, is proud, happy, eager to tell you about that thing they've invented, that thing they've quit college to go start or left their job to go build. And she wouldn't. And that was the hallmark of that meeting. She didn't want to tell me how it worked. And that led me, just that one thing led me to not make that investment in 2006.
Wow. Now, in these pitch meetings, essentially, how much time does a young entrepreneur have to convince you that they're worth investing in?
These meetings, these first meetings, now over Zoom, but these first meetings typically last about an hour, hour and a half.
Okay.
But really in the first 20 minutes, I would say, you size up the person, the opportunity, the market size. Do they have the right background to build the thing that they tell you they're going to go build? That's really, and you have to sort of make that first impression within that hour or so.
Okay. But it seems like it was just this one thing, her refusal to talk about her actual technology that raised alarm bells. Yeah, go ahead.
That's exactly right. And it was an alarm bell. I was a young guy at this firm that I had gotten a job doing venture capital investing after having trained as a physician. But I knew enough even at that point to know, if I can't understand how it works, or the entrepreneur won't tell me how it works, then that's at least a yellow flag, if not a red flag. And look, this meeting had been, she had been walked into our firm by other kind of high profile people in Silicon Valley who had told my colleagues, you have to meet this person. Elizabeth Holmes is going to change the world. She's going to change healthcare. You have to take this meeting. So the setup was, this was going to be something revolutionary. And what actually I heard was lots of revolutionary talk, but nothing that underpinned it with substance. And that's what made it different from a lot of other meetings I've taken over the years.
Okay, but help me understand something, though, because early in the investment stage, in the funding stage that we're talking about here, is it not uncommon for people to come in and say, look, we have this big idea. And here's our business plan. Here's some sort of early descriptions of the technology, but we still need to develop X, Y, Z. And so they can't really talk in detail about the technology because it doesn't yet exist.
There is definitely an element of truth to that. In those early stages, it's really about the idea, where we're going to take it. But often it's underpinned by an invention, especially in healthcare where I spend my time, a technology developed at a university or in a lab. And that at least is something you can get your arms around, even if it's as simple as here's how we think we're going to go do this thing that's very technically complex that could change this particular space in healthcare. And in this particular case, again, so it wasn't that she gave us what we call the hockey stick ramp of financial statements, that we're going to become $1 billion of revenue in 5 years. Well, you know, many entrepreneurs do that. It wasn't that she said we're going to take 50% or 100% of the blood testing market. Well, many entrepreneurs do that. And there's nothing unusual about that. I sort of haircut that in my mind when I hear that. I think most of my peers in venture capital sort of haircut that in their minds of, okay, that's what they all say. But it was the unwillingness or inability to talk about, okay, a little bit more detail on how are we going to do this thing.
Okay, but she convinced others. I mean, other early stage investors who maybe I'm naively presuming should have heard those same alarm bells. How did that happen?
That's a great question. And I spent the next 10 years after I passed on Theranos wondering if I had made a mistake. And I was reminded of it every time there was a press release or a magazine cover or a TED Talk or somebody reminded me at some Silicon Valley bar, a peer of mine, what? You had Theranos in your office in 2006 and you passed at the first round? What were you thinking? And yet others invested. And so every one of those follow-on investments made me think that I had made a mistake.
Okay. Well, Bijan Salihizadeh, stand by for a second, because today we're really taking a look at Silicon Valley culture, but specifically focusing on this stage that you're talking about that early funding stage and whether something's changed about Silicon Valley that allowed fraud on the massive scale that we see happened at Theranos to occur. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And today, in the wake of last week's guilty finding against Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes and her finding that she did perpetuate fraud on her investors, we're asking about whether there is something fundamental to Silicon Valley culture now that allowed that kind of massive fraud to take place. And if so, what could change it? I'm joined today by Dr. Bijan Salihizadeh. He's co-founder of Navimed Capital, and he's been a healthcare venture capital and private equity investor for over 20 years. And we're focusing really on that early stage investment because it's ostensibly one of a couple of points in the process of the founding of a company where accountability, or at least measures of accountability, ought to set in. So, Dr. Salihizadeh, stand by here for just a second because, oh, by the way, we're getting a lot of comments on here. Valera Bochkarev says, I actually think Valera, my producer, took this off the screen, but I think she said, what an idiotic question. In a system designed to squeeze profits out of everything and everyone, why would anyone trust them? Well, Valera, keep tuning in because I don't actually think it's an idiotic question and we're going to find an answer that hopefully satisfies here. And we looked in a lot of different places for those answers, particularly to the history of Silicon Valley and startup culture. So here's Margaret O'Meara, professor of history at the University of Washington and author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America.
There has been great excitement and optimism about technology, technologists, technology companies, that's longstanding. in the late 1970s, early 1980s, when figures like Steve Jobs are popping into the public eye, Bill Gates, these are new style CEOs and new kinds of products that are rising up at a moment when the old economy in the US is stumbling, right? This is happening the same time that Detroit is under assault by Japanese car makers, where the American dream doesn't seem quite as potent as it used to be. And here we have these new companies, these new products that are transformative. And it was a really great 40-year run of incredibly good press and excitement about, and also products, digital devices that have more computing power than the entire Apollo program. And I'm holding one of them in my hand, my iPhone, as I speak to you. It's extraordinary.
But Omera says that a little more than a decade ago, the relationship between tech founders and venture capitalists changed.
The big change occurs in the wake of the Great Recession, 2009 or so, where you have a financial system that has faltered in some areas, in some industries, and where there's a vast amount of money looking for a home. And the best bet on the stock market is our tech and tech-related companies. You look at Apple, you look at the big guys, they are making extraordinary returns for their investors. And so other investors are looking at, where can we get on this rocket ship at the launch pad?
And in the process, tech founders, she says, gained a lot more clout with investors.
One big change is that these young technical founders have entered into agreements that have ensured that even if adult supervision is brought in, that they are neither moved out of their company, nor do they lose control of that company's direction. And really the blueprint for that was Google. When Sergey Brin and Larry Page in 1998, as Stanford graduate students in computer science, ensured that the very generous early rounds of venture capital financing that they received built in space for them to have control. This is the beginning of the spread of dual class stock, in which founders keep a big chunk of control over companies as they grow. So that model has been one that has become more and more common. We see that in Facebook. That's one reason that Facebook doesn't do what Mark Zuckerberg doesn't want it to do. And this also held with Theranos, where, as Elizabeth Holmes' fraud trial made very clear, she had an extraordinary amount of control and power over to the direction of that company, even though she was young and inexperienced and didn't have that much background in that particular space.
All of which leads Professor Omera to this warning.
There's some very exciting companies that are being created, funded, nurtured, and grown in this moment, and new innovations and new exciting entrants into the market. But there also is a lot of other noise. And I think the thing that everyone should remember, whether you're an entrepreneur or an investor or a citizen, is this is a cyclical economy. There is a boom and there is a bust. And this has been a very long ride and a very long boom. But, as someone who studies the history of this industry and the history of American capitalism, I know that booms don't go on forever.
Well, that's Margaret Omera, professor of history at the University of Washington and author of The Code, Silicon Valley, and the Remaking of America. I want to turn now to Micah Rosenblum, who's managing partner at the venture capital firm Founder Collective. Micah Rosenblum, welcome to you.
Hi there.
We talked to Roger McNamee, too, also a longtime Silicon Valley, formerly an investor who first entered that space back in the 80s. And he told us that he would say the big change in the Valley came even earlier, around 2003, because basically tech limitations on processing power, there were much fewer limitations because computers just got that much stronger. And so in his words, when tech was limited, engineers had to work closely with customers, focusing on what customers actually wanted. But without those constraints, founders were free to do whatever produced the biggest return the fastest. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think it's easy to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but I think we have to be careful because Theranos was a bad actor for sure. But over the past decade, we've seen 23andMe, Flatiron Health. I mean, think about this COVID pandemic we've been dealing with. And thank God, probably not too far from you guys, Moderna, who took a huge audacious goal trying to commercialize, mRNA vaccines. And thankfully, being there with the right innovation at the right time. So yes, there is a bad apple in the bunch, but I think that's there's a risk to paint, you know, the entrepreneur ecosystem with that brush. I think it has gotten easier to start a company. I think the tools have gotten better, but that allows more and more people to start companies. If you think about Shopify, if you think about even Facebook, you know, small independent stores using these platforms to whether it's communicate with their customers or sell goods. So yeah, it used to be you have to be, you know, it was the nerds in the research labs at MIT and Stanford. And now it can be anyone, anywhere starting a company, literally out of a Starbucks. I think that's good. I think that's that is what has made, you know, America the entrepreneurial and innovation engine. And I think we want to foster that. And I think we have to be careful. Sure, what Elizabeth Holmes did was wrong, and there will be movies and TV shows. And but she does not represent, I think, the innovation and the types of entrepreneurs in this country. I only see more and more pitch decks every day, every year, of really compelling entrepreneurs. So I'm quite excited about where this goes. And I think in some ways, it's you know, some of these restrictions, you know, that you have to be from one of these pedigreed places have gone away. I mean, you could literally be in any corner of the world and start a pretty exciting company.
Dr. Bijan Salihizadeh, what do you think about that?
I think that's right. I think I agree with you, Micah, in terms of the barriers to entry and even for historically underrepresented entrepreneurs to raise venture capital money have gone down, those barriers to entry. But I also think with the 1,000x or 10,000x returns that the early investors in companies like Facebook and Google received, there has been a flood of new capital. There's a great side to that, as you described. There's also a less than great side to the flood of new capital into places like Silicon Valley in terms of the venture capital ecosystem, which is some, not all, of that new capital is less sophisticated. And I think the question is, and is what is the bar for due diligence and asking the right questions? Thankfully, there was one apple in the bad apple in the 20 years that I've been doing this that I've ever seen, and that was Theranos. There's been one in 20 years that I've seen, and it's a high-profile one. But I do think with all this new The venture capital ecosystem has doubled or tripled just in the last 10 years. And so the question is, are the right questions and safeguards in place at the individual investor level to make sure that they're asking the right questions? And that's not a question for me to decide, but I mean, with great returns comes in more money to back more companies like that.
But isn't that part of why people outside of Silicon Valley, i.e. the rest of us, have these concerns? Because again, I'm just going to quote Roger McNamee, who says that there was basically what he calls a cultural shift in Silicon Valley, where you know, FOMO was really, really high, and we had that handful of like wildly successful founders that kind of walked around like gods, and that made Silicon Valley, in his words, obsessed with founders in a way that would have been unimaginable a generation ago, and that perhaps, you know, makes early stage investors, did it make them a little more willing to overlook the kinds of things, Dr. Salihizadeh, that raised the red flags for you when Elizabeth Holmes sat across that table from you in 2006?
Perhaps. I mean, I think it is noteworthy that no sort of venture capital firms invested in Theranos. Most of her $900 million that Elizabeth Holmes raised came from family offices like the Murdochs and the DeVos family and corporations like Walgreens, not the venture capital firms on Sand Hill Road. I think the real question from my perspective that you're getting to is, you know, the star culture in the Valley that Roger McNamee alluded to. And I wasn't around for the Steve Jobs era, but I saw what had changed from 2009 to 2015 when I lived out there in Palo Alto, which is, and I think Elizabeth Holmes was the beginning of this, the magazine covers, the TED Talks, the popularity in the popular press of these entrepreneurs. Not in and of itself a bad thing, but just, you know, that culture of the entrepreneur as the star, there's a dark side to it as well, which is, you know, does it lead to people overlooking what's the there in terms of what they're building versus what's just the becoming famous part of it? And the other part I've seen is a lot of celebrities, actors, actresses, basketball players are investing in early rounds of technology-heavy companies. Is that a bad thing in and of itself? No. But are they doing sophisticated due diligence to figure out how these things work? I don't know.
But if I may.
Go ahead, Micah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was a founder and actually pitched Bijan's fund 20 some odd years ago. And I would say the culture was really built around the investor. You know, Sand Hill Road and a couple spots in Boston. It was a very finite number of venture capitalists. We used to call Winter Street Mount Money. We would drive up that street or Sand Hill Road, and we would pray that one of those guys, largely white men, and you know, a handful of offices like Sequoia, and you'd hope that they would give you venture capital. And if they didn't, you were kind of out of luck. And with this influx of capital, and certainly there are problems, but with the influx, there's so many more investors you can go to. And I think the power dynamic has shifted. And I think that's what you're alluding to the entrepreneur. The entrepreneur has more leverage. They have more control of their companies. Frankly, they give away less of their company. And I'm not sure that's so bad. I think what's happened is the entrepreneurs who are building these products and technologies are the ones who are celebrated and have a little more control over the companies they're building, as opposed to the investors. Perhaps in the past, it was too investor friendly and too strong onto that side. So I think this is only, and the evidence is, if I talk to peers or I go to, you know, graduate schools and other folks, there are more and more people who want to start companies. They feel more and more empowered. It's a possible career path. Whereas I think 20 years ago, it seemed so risky, so hard to get venture capital, where now truly anywhere around the globe with any background, it does feel like, hey, maybe on Kickstarter, I can put a project out there and get some funding. So I think, again, you have to look in the lens of, is this net positive or not? And I would argue, I think it unlocks more innovation, even though along the way you're going to have some bad apples.
Yeah, no, I hear you on that, right? Because lowering barriers to entry for potentially good ideas is a great thing, and especially, you know, moving it physically out of Silicon Valley to the rest of the country or even the world, sure, also a great thing. But I am curious, and I'll ask both of you this question, Micah, starting with you. Do you think another version of the Theranos fraud could happen again?
You know, look, in every industry, we've seen Madoff, we've seen. So I think this is a pretty extreme view. Like Bijan, I mean, we have 300 companies in the portfolio over a decade. We know of no fraud of any of those companies. We've never seen it. So I think the numbers speak for themselves. Is it possible? Sure. Do I think the pendulum has swung maybe a little bit too far, too much capital, moving too quickly, not doing enough diligence? Yes, I think we've probably swung too far. But I really do believe this is an extreme case. And I wouldn't want people to not take risk because of this example. Mm. So there could be other things out there. But again, it's so rare.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely take risks. But also, Bijan, you talked about guardrails, right? Like, are the guardrails in place when it seems like, from my view externally, like, everyone's really looking for that next big thing. They're looking for that 10,000x that you were talking about.
Yeah, and I think, look, that's always a question. And I don't, I mean, there are no formal guardrails. But I will say for the listeners who are listening to this who aren't venture capitalists themselves, most of them aren't, is that this is a form of investing that the general public doesn't usually take part in. There are limitations in the Securities and Exchange Commission. Mm-hmm. So don't be worried that you yourself are at risk for losing your money. So I think it's important to say that. Most of the people who invest in private companies have to have certain asset tests and, you know, in order to make those investments. So let's make that clear. There were 10,000 investments who got companies who got venture capital investment last year, approximately, around the world. I think at that pace, is it possible that one or two of them were not doing the things that they said they were doing? Very, very much so. But it is that order of magnitude from my perspective. And I think the thing that's very distorted today in today's venture capital ecosystem, I mean right now or in the last year, and Micah will attest to this probably as well, is that there is so much money from big global funds who want to get into the Silicon Valley or New York City or Boston or European companies that are scaling and are doing their due diligence in 3 days or 5 days before they put $100 or $200 million in. And that doesn't mean that's a bad investment or will end badly. But if you're a purist or a traditionalist, you sort of know it takes at least a month of heavy-duty work to figure out if the thing is the thing that you're investing in. And so my odds that there are companies that are being invested in, maybe not outright fraud, but aren't exactly what people think they're investing in, it's probably higher when the pace of capital is so high as it is right now. Mm. It's red hot.
And I would think the work from home, Zoom, you talked about this earlier, but you know, doing all the meetings on Zoom, it does get a bit more transactional. And I think, you know, perhaps that is a risk factor when, you know, perhaps before the pandemic, you would go visit somebody's office, you would meet the people, you would see what they were working on. Hopefully people are still doing that when they get further in the diligence process, but there's less of that. And I would agree that it's moving faster. So I think that's certainly a risk.
Well, Micah Rosenbloom, managing partner at the venture capital firm Founder Collective, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. Salihizadeh, stand by for just a second. Lots of comments coming in. Alex Davidson says Silicon Valley is out to make a buck. You should trust it no more or less than any other business community. And Vanna Pruitt, though, says it's called due diligence, responsibility of the investor. Caveat emptor is what made America what it is today. More in a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're asking about Silicon Valley's founder culture and whether there's something about the billions of dollars sloshing around the valley that allowed the giant fraud perpetuated by Elizabeth Holmes and her company Theranos to take place. And of course, last week, Holmes was found guilty of fraud in a federal court in California. I'm joined today by Dr. Bijan Salihizadeh. He's co-founder of Navimed Capital, and he's been a healthcare venture capitalist and private equity investor for more than 20 years. And joining us now is Kara Swisher, opinion writer for The New York Times and host of the terrific Times podcast, Sway. Kara Swisher, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, you know, we had that listener earlier who sent us a really loving tweet that I'm asking a stupid question about Silicon Valley culture. I mean, is it stupid to question the culture that allowed, even if she's one bad apple, an Elizabeth Holmes to emerge?
No, not at all. But, one of the things that's hard is that Elizabeth Holmes is not Silicon Valley. And I think Silicon Valley has done a lot of trying to distance themselves from her. It's a healthcare company, and it's not a tech company, even though she wore turtlenecks, looked like Steve Jobs. That doesn't make it a tech company. And I think a lot of tech investors actually turned down Holmes, which is interesting. And as you have one here who turned a healthcare person, but she's not seen as Silicon Valley, even though they claim like anything can be technology. A COVID test is technology, right? So I don't know if it's quite Silicon Valley or not, but it's the idea of it's the investment world, I think, is more to the point, is how that is conducted.
Okay, so let's reframe it then and just call it, like, you know, early stage investment and the many, many billions of dollars that are really sort of champing at the bit to find the next unicorn, per se. Like, has there been a culture change there in terms of who gets invested in, how ideas are vetted, et cetera?
No. I mean, no, it's the same thing. It's sort of, it's very monoculture, white, male, younger. The VCs are older. Most of the investments to women continue to be very low and have dropped, I think, since the pandemic. Same thing with people of color. It's not a particularly diverse group of people. They tend to invest in each other. There's been attempts to change that, but small and not very significant. And there's someone who's been doing a lot of investing, for example, is Melinda Gates. And so she's been doing a lot focused on women with through her pivotal ventures and things like that. But in general, no, it's been the same sort of world where I call it, you know, people always talk about Silicon Valley as a meritocracy. It's a phrase I use a lot, but it's a mirrortocracy. They like to look in the mirror and invest in themselves. And that tends to be it. And Elizabeth was an outlier in that regard in terms of she went after different people to invest in, and she sort of put together a FOMA kind of nature where if that guy's there, then I should be there, and if that guy's there, then it must be good, that kind of stuff. But Silicon Valley operates that way, sort of on a handshake and I had a good deal with you last time kind of thing.
You know,
less organized than you think.
So Dr. Salehzadeh said a little bit earlier, pointed out that most of that early $900 million that Holmes raised was from, you know, private families and
yes,
not necessarily sort of, established VC companies. So point taken on that. But let's widen the sort of circle, the area of focus here a little bit, because, I mean, the fraud story makes me wonder about larger levels of trust or diminishment of trust. And I'll just put the Silicon Valley label on it, right?
Okay,
so I've been quoting Roger McNamee, who you know well, Kara, and he said that, like, given many disasters, Brexit, the violence in Myanmar, QAnon, COVID denial, insurrection, etc., AI facial recognition and all its flaws. He asked us, why would anyone trust Silicon Valley? Because using tech to exploit human weakness is the Valley's business now, so trust is not appropriate. So the point there being that, like, there have been things that have gone through the vetting process of investment and made it through that and have had now a really horrible effect on society. So people are kind of questioning the whole thing.
Well, I think your premise is they were trying to be good in the first place. They weren't trying. They were trying to make money, right? They don't care. They don't care if they're doing facial recognition or targeting or whatever. I mean, the problem is you have this vision of technology people as inherently good necessarily. I'm not saying they're bad. It's just they're not different than financial people or real estate people or chemical makers or people who, you know, the meat people who had all that controversy around COVID. These are people who want to make money. And just because they wear sweatshirts and look, you know, have all this money doesn't mean that they have the interests of society. They do say things like that. Like, I did a piece at the Journal 100 years ago because I thought it was ridiculous when I arrived in Silicon Valley. They had, you know, titles like Chief Change Officer, for example. I was like, are you kidding me? Or Chief, you know, Cheerleader. It's ridiculous. You know, just because they're wearing Allbirds and very soft sweatshirts does not mean they have the good of society in their interest at all. They want to make money, and they have a lot of it, as you've noticed. The richest people in the world are all tech people, for example.
Yeah, Dr. Salehzadeh, I'd love to hear your view on this.
Yeah, look, the way the incentive structure is set up is exactly to do as Kara says, you know, which is these aren't inherently bad people who start company. I think most people are inherently good. I tend to want to believe that. But the incentive structure is sell your company for the most you can sell it for. If you're able to take it public on the stock market, there is no incentive to be good. The incentive is maximize earnings per share. And then we rely on humans to generally act within the boundaries of what we expect from other humans. But there is no metric for goodness per share, even though the Google founders told us, you know, don't be evil and all that good stuff that Kara knows so much better than I do. But the metric is earnings per share and, quote, maximizing shareholder value. So the incentive structure at the core of it is set up to maximize profit. I'd say in the venture capital ecosystem, in the younger companies, it's more about, like, getting your product launched, building the early revenues, selling it to someone so that they can take it along the way. But that's still about, you know, becoming successful and making a lot of money. And that is the core of it. And look, I would argue that's why entrepreneurs start companies. One is to change the world and the other is to make money. And you can have both of those goals and I think, you know, be successful in the Valley.
You know, but the change the world part is the part, as the point Kara was making, that they really talk up a lot. I mean, I was looking back at many interviews that Elizabeth Holmes had done over the years, and she's actually she's not different than other founders on this point. Like, every chance she got, she was like, we're going to give people great health. We're going to change their lives. We're going to let them keep going to school and keep going to work. We're going to tell them that they have, you know, they could potentially be at a higher risk of disease, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, she was literally saying, I'm not driven by the billions of dollars. I am driven by this goodness in my heart to grant great health to humanity. And again, she was not different from other founders.
No, it's called that case.
Yeah.
It's called PR. I'm sorry. It's called PR. That's what you would do. I mean, you know, a really good example of a company that's actually doing some good things around privacy is Apple, but it's also in its best interest to do so. It's good for PR. It's good for the branding. If you notice, they're all on the billboards. We protect your privacy. They're using it as both a marketing tool and an ethos within that company, for example. And it's good to screw Facebook too. Like, it's, you know what I mean? Like, it's just why figuring out what the motivation is. But largely when people say they want to change the world, it is PR. It is generally PR, and in order to feel better about themselves in a lot of ways. And they don't want to be seen as just business people. You know, oh, am I the richest person in the world? How did that happen? Right? Like, there's a way these things happen. And then when they make mistakes, that's how they excuse themselves, right? They wrap themselves in this idea. We were trying really hard. We only wanted, and you don't hear bankers. If bankers did it, they'd be laughed out of the room. I want to change the world by distributing money to people so they can buy sandwiches, right? Like, nobody does that. Or, pharmaceutical companies try to do it, but it's really hard since the history is so problematic for many pharmaceutical companies. But you see that language out of them. We're trying to save this. We're trying to do this. And even like BP is beyond petroleum. Like, that was their PR. Like, come on. Like, you know, it's just they're not any different is my point.
Yeah. So let me ask you both. Like, I am always open to reassessing the framing that I come into these conversations mm-hmm. with. And I am now. Maybe that listener told me I was asking a stupid question was right. Because, like, I do wonder, why should we care? Like, if we're just talking about VC companies or very, very wealthy investors or other rich people who are taking a risk, you know, there's upside and downside to any risk. Sometimes it's going to pay off and maybe a great company gets founded. But why should the rest of us care about this? Kara, what do you think?
Because they have impact, because these companies have enormous impact. I mean, Elizabeth Holmes, probably not. That's why probably the jury, which I thought was terrific. I loved the jury system at this point. I thought it was really considered. If you read some of the interviews, they were thoughtful about what they did here. But, you know, because it has impact. Facebook has impact. You know, all of them, privacy, surveillance, this and that on society. And so you have these quasi-governments that are unaccountable running things that are critically important to society, whether it's, you know, the hate stuff or whether it's misinformation or whether it's COVID misinformation. It goes everywhere, this kind of stuff. And given that we rely so heavily on our digital devices, and there's, how many laws do you think there are on technology companies? How many do you think there are?
Oh my God, you're going to interview me, Kara?
No,
I don't.
I'm just asking.
I just don't know. No,
it's
zero.
It's like an eye for going zero.
Okay.
Going to St. Ives, one. Like, there's one, and it's good for them, which is Section 230.
Yeah.
There's one law. There's one law, and it's good for them. So I just like, does any other industry not have any regulations? None of them do. They must be looking at tech and saying, yay, they've got a monopoly and no regulation. And so that's really the issue, is that this is an unregulated group of people who are unaccountable, and they have their hands on the levers of so many important things in society. And so that's why it's really important to think about I'm not a regulator, but there's none. There's mm-hmm. none. There's no privacy bill, national privacy bill. There's no anti-hacking bill. There's no transparency bill. They're around and they're trying to get them passed, but they don't exist. And so that's my biggest issue, is that these are unaccountable people, unregulated, and they happen to be the richest companies on earth in the history of the earth, and they happen to be the richest people. I have no problem with them being wealthy, but it's interesting that the richest people in the world are the unregulated, monopolistic type of people. Mm-hmm.
Let me turn back to Bijan, because I think this is a really important point, and I would still argue that there should be, ideally, some little moments of accountability, and that the investment stages should be some of them. So first of all, Dr. Salihizadeh, like, respond to what Kara is saying about why the rest of us should care.
I think Kara's right. I think these companies do have impact. But I would say, look, in addition to that impact, Silicon Valley tends to be a harbinger. It's a little tiny corner of finance in this big massive planetary finance system we have. But this little tiny corner has a disproportionate impact, and it also tends to be a harbinger for the rest of society writ large of kind of what's coming down the pike. And I think we should care, because those things about the star culture, or the famous Rosewood Hotel on Sand Hill Road, where all the venture capitalists get together and talk about companies and which ones they passed on and didn't pass on, it's such a FOMO culture. And I saw that a decade earlier. Kara probably has seen it in multiple waves,
oh, yeah,
having covered this ecosystem so extensively. And it has bled into other parts of our society, celebrity culture, star culture, which maybe, you know, Silicon Valley is an early indicator of where things have gone. And so I think those guardrails, of course, in terms of investment, yeah, it is caveat emptor. We need to all do our due diligence as investors to figure out what's real and what's not. We've been handed this great pile of money by pension funds and other investors who've asked us to invest it responsibly on their behalf. That's what we do. And we have to be responsible with it. But, you know, once we hand that baton to the next runner, you don't know what happens. These companies get taken public and the incentive structures get doubled down on. And we have some of the things that Kara just told us about.
Yeah. So, you know, I have...
Let me just say, there's no VC ever that went, please, please don't make more money. Like, there's just never happens. Just, they don't want to do that. And they also don't think that's their job. And I don't actually think it's their job. They're not here to be society's watchdogs. They're here to make money. And so, again, we expect them to do the right thing. And they should be responsible on behalf of the OPM, which is other people's money. And that matters, of course. But otherwise, they're here to make as much money as they can in the shortest amount of time.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Elizabeth Holmes is one example. I haven't yet said the word WeWork yet. There's another example, but you know what?
Sort of. There was no fraud there. Let's be clear. That was it was in their S-1. Like, let me, you know, whatever you think of Adam Neumann, they knew what he was doing, and he said he was doing what he was doing, and therefore they decided to ride it. So that's not a similar thing, because it was in plain sight what was happening, and not particularly illegal, just kind of odd, is, you know, like letting someone.
But people believed in him, though, right? I mean, isn't that the point?
I think his investors believed they could trade it up to the next thing. And then the minute the S-1 got out, everyone was like, I mean, Sean, did you read it? We were all like, whoa, that's
yeah,
math.
I think that was
I kept
bad,
going math.
Bad corporate governance.
Okay.
Yeah.
That board
yeah.
abdicated its duties when they let him build apartment buildings and all the other yeah. things he was doing.
He's doing that now. That's what he's doing.
Well, so let me ask you about there's one thing that I find really peculiar, but one of the things I find peculiar, which is there does seem like a culture shift, and Margaret O'Meara, the professor of history, talked about it a little earlier in the show, about how much not just investment but power is given to founders who are now oftentimes like really young, and then they maintain that power, whereas in the past it could have been those initial investors that could have had a greater ability to put the brakes on when ideas go bad.
I mean, John, you talk about that. You can't. There's no way.
Well, look, I mean, I don't know if the investors would have put the brakes on that. I will say, and I've never, you know, never backed one of the companies where the founder insists that they can't be fired and their title can't be changed. I think that's just so horrible for governance if a founder has those terms. Look, I know it's worked out with Zuckerberg, and maybe Larry and Sergey had that, Kara. You'll know the specifics. But
yes,
I think that's just bad for corporate responsibility if someone can't be fired or demoted. It's just bad.
Nor their children, by the way.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I wrote a whole column on this and these kind of these dual stock structures. Look, the New York Times has it too. So there's all kinds of like, it depends. It depends on what's going on. But why wouldn't you want this if you were a founder? Why wouldn't you want maximum? And a lot of times VCs do screw founders if something goes wrong. And so to have maximum control makes a lot of sense from a founder. You invented it. You don't want some guy in khakis coming over and telling you what to do. Like, so that's, you know, founder culture is not going to die in Silicon Valley at any point, now or forever, I think.
Well, Kara Swisher is a writer at The New York Times and host of The Times podcast, Sway. Thank you so much for joining us, Kara.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bijan Salihizadeh, co-founder of Navimed Capital and has been in healthcare venture capital and private equity for 2 decades. Dr. Salihizadeh, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.